A master of the crime fiction genre and literary fiction steps out with a new whodunit.
I'm less interested when it comes to any mystery. I'm less interested in whodunit. I'm much more interested in why done it and in what this huge upheaval of murder does to everybody surrounded by it, how it affects their minds, how it sends ripples out to change everything that touches it.
That's Tana French. We spend the hour talking with her, first about her new novel, The Witch Elm. It got a stellar review from Stephen King. Then we re-air our 2016 interview with her about her last to date in the Dublin Murder Squad series, The Trespasser. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. When we last interviewed American-Irish writer Tana French in 2016 about her novel The Trespasser, I wrote that she's been called the most interesting, most important crime novelist to emerge in the past 10 years. She earned that reputation for her Dublin Murder Squad crime series, of which The Trespasser was one. Now she's out with a new novel, but it isn't part of that series, or any series for that matter. Instead of telling the story from the point of view of police detectives, The Witch Elm tells it from the point of view of, well, one of us, an ordinary person, someone for whom a murder that happens in their circle is a profoundly disorienting and unsettling experience. The book's protagonist is Toby Hennessy, a young man of good looks, good luck, and a sunny personality. But his luck runs out when he's the victim of a brutal assault that leaves him with a damaged brain and PTSD. Then, as if things couldn't get worse, a skull is discovered in a tree on a family property, and Toby becomes one of the suspects. When you pick up a Tana French novel, you know you're in for a deep exploration of character and motive. The Witch Elm is no exception to that rule. It concerns itself with two big questions. The first, what may be some of the negative consequences of being, in air quotes, lucky? What does it do to our ability to feel compassion for others less lucky than ourselves? The second question follows hard on the heels of the first. How do we cope when our sense of self is upended by trauma, especially when we're used to being lucky? And how to build a new sense of self on a perhaps more solid foundation. What Toby learns about himself in the course of wrestling with those questions doesn't necessarily improve his luck, but it does make him a deeper, more humble, and compassionate person. Tana French is the winner of the Edgar Award and the Irish Book Award, among other honors. The Witch Elm is her seventh novel. The previous six are in the Dublin Murder Squad series. Tana French, welcome back to Writer's Voice.
Thank you for having me back on.
The Witch Elm, I think I say this each time I read one of your books. This is my favorite, but this one is my favorite.
Thank you so much. I'm very glad.
Now, it's the witch is spelled W-Y-C-H. Is there any such a thing as a witch elm?
Yeah, there is. It's a tree that is, it's fairly common in England and Ireland anyway, and it shows up here and there in various forms of mythology and sort of medieval herbals. And in ancient Greek mythology, one grew at the entrance to the underworld. So I thought it was an interesting thing to have in the book.
So we've talked with you about two previous novels, The Trespasser and The Secret Place. Mm-hmm. These are both in the Dublin Murder Squad series. And the last time we talked, you hinted that the next book would not be one of the Dublin Murder Squad series, which is the case here. Why did you decide to take this avenue here, to go outside that series and do a standalone book? I assume it's standalone.
Yes, it is a standalone book. Basically, I think it's very easy, especially if you're writing within the same genre where the overall framework is pretty much fixed. There's a temptation to get into writing the same book over and over. And I had, the parameters of the Dublin Murder Squad were pretty much in place. And I think it would have been quite easy to slide into that, and I don't want to do that. So I decided to take a step back from the series for a while. And I'd looked at the process of a criminal investigation from the detective's point of view 6 times, but I kept thinking about all the other people involved. Like, you've got perpetrators, witnesses, suspects, victims. How is that criminal investigation going to look from their point of view, from their perspective? Like, for the detective, all the procedural stuff, the detective's completely at home with that. He or she is, they're the one controlling it and driving it, and it's a source of power, of strength, and it's a way of, like, reestablishing order in a chaotic world. But for all those other people involved, the investigation's got to look completely different. It's alien and it's incomprehensible, and it has to be quite often terrifying. Mm-hmm. It's, rather than giving them control, it takes control away, and it's a source of chaos. It upends their whole lives. And I wanted to give a voice to all of those other perspectives as well. And Toby Hennessy, the narrator, is at various points in the book, he's all of those things.
So, Toby, tell us about this narrator. It's all from his point of view. He's the major protagonist, but there are other very, very strong characters in the book. Tell us about him.
Toby is basically a happy-go-lucky young guy with a nice life, good job in PR, lovely girlfriend, good friends. Basically, everything in life has always gone his way. He's always been lucky. And that has been nice for him, obviously, but there are ways in which it stunted him emotionally. He's never had to think very much about the fact that other people might not be living life on quite as easy a difficulty setting as he is, that for other people, the experience of just living in this world might be a very different thing from what it is to him. He's basically existed in a state of cheerful oblivion until one night burglars break into his apartment and beat him up pretty badly, and he's left with traumatic brain injury with not the worst side effects you can have, but there's a certain amount of, he's got difficulty with speech, with memory, with a limp, and he's also got post-traumatic stress disorder. And his entire sense of himself is shattered and transformed, and his entire sense of his relationship to the world around him.
Yes, you know, you were reviewed by Stephen King, and who gave you a rave review, by the way, in the New York Times, which was fantastic.
I'm still recovering from that. I'm still picking my jaw up off the floor, Stephen King, wow.
Yeah. Now, he says, you know, he starts out the review with the first sentence in your book, being, quote, "I've always considered myself to be basically a lucky person." And he says that the book is a meditation on luck. So I wanted to ask you first, what did you think about that?
I think that's very much, yes, what I was hoping that it would do. Because I had been thinking, where the book came out of was, I'd been thinking a lot about luck and what it can do to our sense of empathy, whether it can stunt empathy. Like, if you're too lucky in some field of life, it can be quite hard to realize that other people are living in different realities and that their experience may be very different from yours. I mean, my most obvious example is I had a pretty happy, well-loved childhood. And for me, that meant that when I was a teenager, say, if somebody told me about their really terrible childhood, there would be a part of my brain that was going, I can't have been that bad. They've got to be exaggerating. It wasn't that I thought the person was lying. It was just that this was so outside my frame of reference that I had no way of taking it in as reality. And, you know, I grew up and I realized that, no, actually my reality does not define everybody else's. But I started thinking about, what about somebody who had been lucky in every way all through his life, who, you know, he's white, male, straight, mentally healthy, physically healthy, good-looking, charming, all of it.
Wealthy.
What would that do to his ability? Yeah, wealthy, from a stable home, like I said. What would that do to his ability to recognize that other people are not living in that world? And what would it do if suddenly his luck changed and his entire perception of the world and of himself was shattered?
Right. And I'll come back to that, but it's actually what you say, the very last thing that you said there, that had me thinking that there's really also an other theme to the book, which is identity, personality. What happens when we go through a trauma and we have to question everything about ourselves?
Yes, absolutely. I was thinking a lot about that as well, because we all have been through those moments where you feel like something in you has been shattered or irrevocably transformed. And what do you do about it? To what extent are you able to rebuild or to pick yourself up or to reframe your mental image of yourself and carry on from that point? And Toby finds that extremely difficult. And all the other characters in the book have, at different points in their life, gone through these upheavals. And one of the characters, his Uncle Hugo, who's dying of brain cancer, has a line where he says something like, one gets used to being oneself, and it takes some great upheaval to crack that and show you what else might be lying underneath. And I think those moments can be, depending on how they're approached, very revelatory and show you what else has been lying inside waiting for its moment. And all the characters deal with these moments of devastation and transformation in very different ways.
Yes, I mean, I personally can relate to that because last year I was diagnosed with breast cancer, which luckily I think has been cured, but I always thought of myself as a healthy person. And after that happened, I cannot take my health for granted. So this was a very moving to me what Toby goes through, because after all, he has PTSD, he has memory lapse, and it leads to a kind of, even one could say, overcompensation, a kind of paranoia, whereas before he might have thought everything was rosy in life and nothing too bad could happen. Now he doesn't know if the worst can happen.
Yes. I'm really sorry you went through that. Glad to hear that. Fingers crossed, everything is back to normal. But I think it isn't something that you get past mentally, even when it's over physically, because the world is in fact a different place. And that's what happened to him. It's everything's quicksand. Everything that he thought of as a solid surface is quicksand now. And he doesn't know how to respond to that. And as you say, we've all been through that moment where suddenly everything that you took for granted in yourself and in the world is no longer there.
You're listening to Writer's Voice, and we're talking with Tana French about her newest mystery novel, The Witch Elm. So now this, his sunny disposition, his erstwhile luck, although one could argue in some ways he's lucky throughout the book, even so, is in stark contrast to at least one of his cousins. Now, he has two cousins in the book who are more like siblings to him. That's Susanna and Leon. Tell us about them and their relationship to each other, at least as mediated through his own thinking, because that's the only point of view we have in the book.
Yes, they are, as far as he's concerned, at the beginning of the book anyway, the three of them roughly grew up together, running in and out of the Ivy House and staying there together for holidays. They're all about the same age within a few months. And as far as he's concerned, this was all very idyllic. They had a great time together, picnics and camping out in the garden and teenage parties. From his perspective, this was all absolutely lovely. But as the book continues, he's forced to reevaluate all of that, because from their perspective, there were entirely different things and much darker and more fragmented things going on. And he starts to realize that their relationship with each other was in some ways an alliance from which he was excluded. Because while he was having the easiest time that anyone can have with adolescence, which is, by definition, not an easy time, they were not. They were having much more difficult times. They were having almost daily struggles to keep it together and to keep themselves from being bullied or picked on, harassed in various ways. And they feel that he was not there for them in the way that he has always thought of himself as being. And so this is another thing that he's having to reassess, and where he's not able really to hold on to his perception of himself is within that relationship with his cousins, which was a very defining relationship for him. And he's being forced to accept their definition of it as having a certain validity as well. But this idea of different viewpoints being different is, again, very destabilizing and frightening for him at a point when everything else is unstable, too.
Exactly. So let's talk a little bit about the plot then. You have this terrible assault on Toby in the beginning of the book. And then about halfway through, it becomes apparent that a murder has been committed, although it hasn't been committed in any recent time. But long ago, this is a skull is found in the Witch Elm. This is where the Witch Elm comes in. And this is at Ivy House, where Uncle Hugo is. Tell us about the situation here. Toby is in Ivy House with his Uncle Hugo and with his girlfriend, Melissa.
Yes, and for him, this is the Ivy House is this idyllic haven that was his favorite place through childhood, and he's come back here, and he feels that in a way it's putting him back together. It's reconnecting him with his past, his cousins, his old self, and his cousins are in many ways the definers of his old self. They're the people who knew him when he was too little to have any kind of sense of concealment or company manners or anything like that. They've known the core of him since day one, and he associates them with the place. So this is very much a healing experience for him, and he's starting to stick himself back together. And just at the point where he feels like he might just get back on some kind of stability again, a skull is found down the trunk of this big witch elm at the bottom of the garden. And of course, this prompts an entire criminal investigation, which naturally enough is focused on anybody who has access to the garden of the Ivy House, meaning Toby and his family. And so that triggers this entire destabilization of his sense of his past and who, not only who he is now, but who he was when he was younger. And it also puts him under threat, not just psychologically, but in much more concrete terms, because there are detectives in and out questioning him, questioning his cousins, questioning his uncle, and he doesn't know what they're thinking. He doesn't know who they might suspect of what, and he, of course, can't even trust his memory, so he doesn't even know who he should be suspecting of what.
In fact, he suspects himself.
At certain points in the book, he does, yeah, because he doesn't know what else might be in there in his mind at this point. Everything is up for grabs. Nothing is stable. So he has no idea what else might be in there.
Right. I hope I didn't give anything away by saying that.
I don't think that's too spoiler.
Now, you know, it's interesting. The book, there are long stretches in the book where there's no external action happening. What's really, or there's no, like, the plot is not being driven forward. The murder mystery itself is not being driven forward. It's a real exploration of the psychological landscape, the interior landscape of Toby, and also of his relationship, all the things that we've just been talking about. Now, one reviewer, criticized it, thought it went on too long that way. I disagree with that. I found it fascinating, precisely because, well, your work is very much about the psychological mysteries in the human heart, and it allows us to delve into them. And also, the writing is absolutely terrific. But I wonder if that took a bit of courage on your part to kind of let the external action of the book lie fallow for so long.
Yeah, it was a risk, and I knew it was a risk. But I'm less interested when it comes to any mystery. I'm less interested in who done it. I'm much more interested in why done it and in what this huge upheaval of murder does to everybody surrounded by it, how it affects their minds, how it sends ripples out to change everything that touches it. And especially when you're doing something as kind of psychologically enormous as what I was taking on in this one, which is his entire sense of identity, sense of the world. These are some pretty core human mysteries. Who are we? How much are we stable and how much of us is fluid? To what extent can we be changed and shaped by what goes on around us versus to what extent are we just who we are and to what extent is that a stable thing within us? I figured that's something that I have to allow the space to develop properly if it's going to have any depth, if the character is going to have the resonance and the depth to pull this off. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. I hope that every bit within it drives forward that core plot question of who is Toby turning into mm-hmm. as we watch him? What is he going to turn into now that his original self has been broken and he's just left with the pieces? And I hope that even when the whodunit element isn't being driven forward, that the fact that the core mystery of who Toby is and who he's going to be able to make himself into now that his self has been shattered and he's just been left with the pieces, I hope that that will be enough to keep readers moving forward with him.
Well, absolutely. You know, he starts out being this golden boy. He goes through this trauma, and he becomes a much deeper, more thoughtful person by the end.
Yes, I think so, and I hope so. And he does transform over the course of the book. And to me, that was the core plot arc of the book. I mean, I'm always about characters. I love gripping plots, and I love reading and try to write plots that keep hold of you. But for me, it's always about the character. That's what I'm interested in. What's their journey? How are they? Where are they going to end up, and how are they going to get there? So I'm fascinated by that. So I just kind of keep my fingers crossed that enough readers are happy for that to be the core arc of the book.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Tana French, mystery writer extraordinaire, about her newest novel, The Witch Elm. Now, I was reading this book while the Kavanaugh, the hearings for Judge Kavanaugh to be a member of the Supreme Court were going on. And there is a line in the book that very much resonated with those external events. A young man who has been quite abusive, let's say, to a woman in the book. And I found it really striking. You always have used your novels to explore some of the social issues that are going on. And of course, you wrote this way before Judge Kavanaugh, but perhaps at the same time that our president, who also has been accused of sexual assault, was in fact, you know, running for office. So I wonder if you could talk about how you weave in these contemporary social issues and controversies into your work.
It's definitely and genuinely not deliberate. I never set out to write a book with a social message or a book that taps into social issues. But I think that if you're writing, and for some reason I think especially if you're writing mystery, it's very easy for social context to come in. Because murder happens in every society, every time and place. But the reasons for which it happens and the way it happens are very much shaped by that time and place and by, you know, the tensions and the fears and the dark places within it. And so I think, although I don't set out to integrate social issues into it, if this is what you're hearing about and thinking about, and if you're trying to think through what's my own response to this shift in society where people are no longer expected to accept simply being lesser citizens, but, you know, a few of those who have been in a position of power are unwilling to relinquish their position of power. If there's this tension going on in the society all around you and this growing awareness from people who have never realized what other people's lives are like, there's this growing awareness of, oh, my God, you know, take the Me Too movement. More and more men becoming aware, that's what women's daily lives are like? Seriously? How did I never know this? If this sudden explosion around the issue of empathy and other and recognizing others' experience is happening, I think it's very easy for it to seep into what you're doing as a writer, and in particular as a mystery writer, almost on a subconscious level.
Mm-hmm. You know, your writing just is so stellar, and yet it seems so effortless. Did you experience any real challenge in writing this book in particular?
Oh, yeah. I with all of the books, it's there are different challenges. With this one, it was... I really enjoyed writing this one, oddly enough. It was one of the ones that I found the most, it's going to sound strange, but that I found the most fun, purely because it's set in a different world. I didn't have any of the parameters and the boundaries set down that I had for the Dublin Murder Squad. Like when I was writing, not the first one, but all the others, there were certain things I knew I couldn't do because I'd already set out the outlines of this world, the Dublin Murder Squad world. But this one, I could do anything. Anything could happen. There were no rules left. But while that is a lot of fun, it was also kind of scary because I was going, okay, am I doing this all wrong? Because I have nothing left that I can say, okay, it worked last time, it's probably okay. I was completely in uncharted territory, and that can be pretty scary. And there's also the fact that, as you've said, this is less procedural heavy and less driven by the murder investigation itself. And I was going, okay, I kind of need that structural arc of the murder investigation to keep me into place, because I write long anyway. I like writing. I like going off on little discursive tangents. And I was going, if I don't have that arc firmly nailed into place at beginning and end of the book, I could just keep writing and turn in a million-word book in 5 years' time. So that was a little bit scary.
Well, and tell us a little bit about your writing process. I mean, do you do this every day? Do you get up at 6 o'clock in the morning and write till noon? How does it work for you?
Well, in an ideal world, I'd kind of write until 3 a.m. and then sleep till 11, but I have little kids, so that is not happening. So I write when they're out of my hair, basically. Mm-hmm. Once they're both in school, then I write until they're not anymore, and which is, I think, probably as many hours as I could do in a day anyway, because I tend to edit and re-edit and re-edit a bit that I've done, so that by the time I finish a first draft, I'm only a few weeks away from handing it in because I edit every bit as I go. So mainly, yeah, the process is working around small kids and their needs. That and a lot of caffeine and a lot of long walks. Those are my two main crutches as a writer.
And I have to say, then, I'm not surprised at some of the characterizations of little kids in this book, The Witch Elm.
Little kids are fun to write, and they're fun to write because the same thing as a structure, they follow their own rules. They have their own agenda and are living in a parallel world, so that's always fun to write.
Absolutely. Well, Tana French, it was hugely fun to read The Witch Elm, and I want to thank you so much for talking with us again on Writer's Voice, and I look forward to another conversation about your next book, which I'm sure is coming.
Thank you, and thank you so much for having me back on.
Tana French. Go to writersvoice.net to read an excerpt from The Witch Elm. Next up, we air our 2016 interview with French about The Trespasser. It's part of the Dublin Murder Squad series. Stay tuned after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Back in 2016, we talked with crime novelist Tana French about her last novel to date in the acclaimed Dublin Murder Squad series, The Trespasser. Let's listen back to that conversation now. American-Irish writer Tana French has been called, quote, the most interesting, most important crime novelist to emerge in the past 10 years. Her novels are intimate explorations of character and motive, told in vivid language that fairly leaps off the page. Each novel takes a different detective from the Dublin Murder Squad as its protagonist, preserving the setting of the series, but changing the frame. French's latest in the series is The Trespasser. Its protagonist is the only woman on the squad, Antoinette Conway. She's also multiracial. She's smart, tough, and she has a huge chip on her shoulder. Is it because she's the victim of racist and sexist harassment from her coworkers? Or does her pugnacious defensiveness create her own isolation? Meanwhile, Conway's got a tough case to solve that just might implicate someone in the murder squad itself. Well, Tana French, welcome back to Writer's Voice.
Thank you so much for having me back. It's great to be on.
This was just a terrific book, The Trespasser, and Murder Mystery in Your Hands is really a chance to explore the psychology of your characters very deeply. And each book has a different protagonist, unlike a lot of other mystery writers. This one especially focuses on the character of Antoinette Conway, a police detective who was not the main character in the last one, but it is her second appearance. All your books introduce a character that becomes a protagonist in the next book. Why do you structure it this way?
Well, the traditional thing to do with a detective series is to have the main protagonist and follow them straight through. And I love writing series like that. I love reading series like that. But the problem with writing them is that what I like focusing on is the huge turning point in the narrator's life, the moment where that barrier between personal and professional comes crashing down, and the narrator knows that whatever choice he or she makes, his or her life is never going to be the same place again. And the thing is that you don't really actually get that many moments like that in a real life. So when I was coming to the end of my first book, In the Woods, I was thinking, well, either I can keep giving the same narrator huge life-changing moments every couple of years, and he's going to end up in a straitjacket by about book four, or else I can do the traditional thing and follow the detective through the smaller ups and downs of life, which doesn't really interest me as much, or else I can switch narrator. And so I ended up switching narrator. And it also gives me a chance to focus on different themes, because there are only a certain number of preoccupations and themes and, you know, underlying motifs that are core to any one person. And if the theme of the book isn't also a core theme in the life of the detective, you run the risk of having the narrator become a bit disconnected from the book, which I think isn't as strong. So the fact that I'm switching narrator means that I can focus on a different set of themes every time while still having them be absolutely core to the narrator's life, and I like that.
So we talked with you last time about the book The Secret Place, and this time on The Trespasser. What is the shift that you made between that book and this one in terms of how you focused, the theme you focused on?
Well, last time, The Secret Place, it focuses around a group of teenage girls and also around the narrator, Stephen Moran. And for all of them, the core theme is identity and who are you going to allow to define your identity? I mean, for teenagers, that is the core theme very much. How are you going to decide who you are and who are you going to allow to have a hand in that decision? And for Stephen as well, he was very much a people pleaser, somebody who would be anyone else wanted him to be. And so for him, that idea of who's going to decide who you are was also core. But Antoinette is the opposite. She has a very, very clear idea of who she is and has absolutely no intention of letting anybody else ever have any say in that. And I was thinking about how that has a good side, but it also has a downside in that we all tend to make up narratives about our lives. We all tend to have an idea about what story our life is playing out, who we are in this story, and how everything else fits into it. And I think most of us shift that story in response to the outside reality, in response to what's actually going on around us. But if you're too reluctant to allow anybody else to have any say, any input, then you can become like Antoinette, where you start bending reality in order to fit your personal narrative. And also, like the victim in The Trespasser, Ashlyn Murray, who starts deliberately trying to bend reality to fit the way she wants her personal narrative to go. And I think the underlying theme in this one is what can happen when that personal narrative gets dangerously out of control.
Right. And actually, you know, in some ways, it is that character, and I'd like to ask you to describe it a little bit more, but it is Antoinette's character that on the one hand makes her a really good cop, but also undermines her ability to be a good cop.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, she's forceful, she's savagely tough, she takes no nonsense. All of these are good things. But at the same time, being a detective involves working with other people, working as a team. And that is not necessarily one of her fortes. And she's in the murder squad, which is a very small, tight-knit, elite squad where it's got a very specific atmosphere of its own. And she got off on the wrong foot there and absolutely refuses to do anything to remedy that because, hey, why should I, basically? And that's led into a spiral where she's on the receiving end of all kinds of everything from harassment down to downright sabotage from some members of her squad. And that's got her to the point where she's so paranoid that she's no longer quite able to tell what exactly is her paranoia and what is reality. So it's had its downside, her lack of flexibility. It's got her into she's painted herself into a corner and can't get out.
And she had a previous confrontation with the person who became the murder victim. It not just affects the way she works with others, but also with how she works with the folks that she's investigating or the people who come into the station.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think she would probably tell herself that it doesn't. But the fact is that it very much does. She doesn't have a lot of patience with people who she considers to be foolish in any way. And so she ends up cutting them off, shutting them off in moments where she should be doing the opposite. It's, I guess, one of the reasons she and Stephen make a good pair is because he does the opposite. He's very open to whatever's coming in from every direction, and she isn't, and they balance each other out well.
Yeah, and for somebody who perhaps hadn't read the previous book, The Secret Place, which is told from Stephen Moran's point of view, you might be questioning his character as well if you were reading this book.
I think that's one of the advantages of switching narrators every time, is that you get to see the previous narrator from somebody else's point of view, and you get to see the new narrator from their point of view, which is a change. And nobody's view on themselves is objective reality, exactly, and nobody's view on themselves is going to be the same as a friend's or a rival's or somebody else's. And so, yeah, I hope you do find yourself questioning characters from previous books when they're seen in a different light and thinking, well, which is the real perspective? Which is the true one? It may not be that different, but the slight shifts can be crucial. What does this person mean by that? What were they? What was their actual motive? Were they being honest with themselves? Is the current narrator being honest with themselves? Who is this person really? And is it as simple as it was presented the first time?
Yeah, and before we move on from Antoinette, the big chip on her shoulder and her paranoia, I mean, it's to some degree based in fact. Tell us where it's coming from. It's not just about her personality.
No, it's not just about her personality. It stems probably, to start with, from the fact that her father ran off on her and her mother before Antoinette was born. She's never met him. And her mother spent her childhood telling Antoinette stories about who her father had been. You know, he was a Brazilian guitarist, he was a Saudi prince, he was an Egyptian doctor. And all of those stories satisfied Antoinette for a little while until she realized that there was a flaw in them and they couldn't possibly be true. And she's become very resistant to any attempt at all to define her story by other people, just furiously resistant to any attempt by anyone to define her. And when she sees that, whether her perception is real or not, when she sees that in the rest of the squad, she instantly goes furiously on the defensive. And it does track back to that early feeling that somebody else has been defining her story for her.
So I have a question that puzzles me, and you don't have to answer it if you feel it's going to give away anything in the plot that you don't want to. Okay. But she does confront her father at some point, and she utterly rejects him. Why?
I think that's very much who she is. We're kind of trained by narrative to think that everybody wants a great big emotional outburst for closure. That's the closure they want, is they want absolute emotional openness and understanding and enlightenment. But I don't think that's the kind of closure that everybody wants. I don't think everybody has a need for that. And Antoinette genuinely doesn't. The closure she wants between her and her father is for her to be the one calling the shots. That's all she wants from him. She doesn't want to know who he is and what he is and what he feels about her, and she doesn't want to cry on his shoulder and have a big huggy reunion. All she wants is for her to call the shots this time and for him not to have any power anymore over her. And while there is the instinct in her that goes, yes, let me ask all the questions, let me hear all the stories, she feels that that would be another step towards allowing him to define who she is, which in some ways he has done since day one. And she's not going to bite on that lure. She absolutely refuses. She's not going to go for what to her would be a very cheap concept of closure. She's going to go for the one that she wants.
Well, that's great. That's a very satisfying answer. If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Tana French about her new novel, The Trespasser. Now, the murder victim, 26-year-old Ashlyn Murray, now usually the murder victim in a novel is not particularly fleshed out, at least not after their death. And she dies pretty early in this story. So, in fact, she's dead by the time the story opens. But
she's dead from day one.
She really unfolds as a character herself, which I found one of the most fascinating threads in this absolutely wonderful book. Could you talk a little bit about Ashlyn Murray?
Thank you. I mean, I hope she does. I hope she does come to life, because I think that's one of the things I don't like, is that murder mysteries, whether real or fictional, tend, not always, but it's a risk that the victim gets sidelined. And of course, the victim is the one who had most at stake in all of this, and I don't want to sideline the victim. She appears to be, from Antoinette's standpoint, basically dead Barbie. She is blonde, she's pretty, she's groomed, all her sitting room, her house is all perfect, everything's absolutely perfect, it could come from a glossy magazine. And Ashlyn puts her down as basically somebody who's turned herself into a Barbie doll. But it turns out, little by little over the course of the book, that Ashlyn was much more complicated than that. She had her own agenda. Everything she did for a very specific reason. She was not being passive in any way. She was trying to make events go the way she had planned them. And everything she did was factored towards that goal.
In a way, she was defining herself by hiding who she is.
Yes. She was creating a new her who would function as a tool for the real her. And she felt that that was something that could be done in a temporary way and then discarded when it didn't suit her needs anymore, because she didn't really have a very strong sense of who the real her was because of her own circumstances and the way that her life has been defined by her father leaving when she was 10. And she felt that she could construct a persona who would be useful for her goal and then discard it. But she didn't really understand that even if it's a constructed persona, its actions have very real consequences. You can't always control it. Things can get out of control very easily. And that's what happened.
Yeah, exactly. And now, when this case is first brought to Antoinette and Stephen, they think it's a straight up, lover's quarrel case that goes terribly wrong. They blame the boyfriend, Rory Fallon, who's a bookshop owner and a sensitive man, we should say.
A good guy.
Yeah, he is a good guy. Although Antoinette, I just have to quote this from her description of him, because it really shows the kind of fierce, savage language she uses in the book to such effect. She says, he's such a goddamn damp weenie, the kind who needs regular slaps across the back of the head just to keep him from vanishing up his own hole.
Yeah, she doesn't like him very much. But Ashlyn did. Mm-hmm. Ashlyn really, really did. That's the thing. She had found somebody who was perfect for her, but her other plans got in the way.
Yeah, exactly. I think he becomes the vehicle for some of the most gripping scenes in the book. These are interrogation scenes, which are absolutely impeccable. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about your process in arriving at them, where they just seem so completely spot on and spellbinding.
Interrogation scenes, it's weird. They're actually some of the most difficult to write, because usually you've got a certain amount of room for digression. Characters can take the scene in one direction or another, the whims can come in, but in an interrogation scene, everybody involved has an absolutely clear motivation. The motivation is never going to be part of the mystery that you can slowly reveal as you go on. The detectives want the information. The other person wants to keep that information hidden. So the motives are laid out on the table already, so that kind of takes away a layer of the mystery you're able to use. And also, there are very specific markers that have to be hit along the way. This bit of information has to come out. This bit of information has to be used against the character. So you've got a structure almost inbuilt into the scene, where usually you can let it go off on its own tangent and see where that takes you. So the interrogation scenes are the most highly structured. And one of the things that makes them more interesting to write is that the detectives in an interrogation focus on the subject with such absolute intensity and such a high level of perception. They're trying to figure out who this person is because they need to know that in as much depth as possible so that they can use the tools that will work on this particular person. What does this person want? Who will he respond to? What's he thinking? They have to be one step ahead the whole time, and that's the way they're working. It's all about a kind of enforced and terrifying intimacy that the detectives are pushing and that obviously the suspect is going to try to avoid. And that's what happens between them and Roy. They're trying to figure out who he is, what does he need, and what is the thing that we can offer him that will make him come out with all the information he's got.
And did you do any kind of research into actual interrogations, or are these really made up, you know, do you just have the sense of it?
No, I've watched videos of interrogations, I've read a lot of transcripts, and I've read about their specific techniques that detectives can be trained in order to do interrogations. But the thing is that you have to take a certain amount of artistic license, because a real interrogation can last 12 hours, you know, 8 hours with breaks and all that. But it can last for hours and hours and hours. And an awful lot of that will be repetition, coming back on the same thing from different angles. Well, let's take this over again, tell us the whole story again. And in a book, that's not going to work. My books are long enough already. If I throw in a 12-hour interrogation scene, everyone's going to give up and go home, you know? So you have to condense it. And that's the other thing that's quite difficult, because in reality, it does take time to move somebody from the point where they're absolutely not going to tell you anything to the point where they will tell you everything. And you have to find ways when you're writing a book to condense that down so that it's psychologically plausible, but it doesn't bore the reader to death.
We're talking with Tana French about her new novel, The Trespasser. And then the other aspect, I mean, the other character, and I think you already alluded to this in some way, is the squad itself, the murder squad itself, and even more so in this book. Could you talk a little bit about that, how that becomes so much of the focus of this book, although the murder victim is part of it, is really on the internal relationships of that squad?
Yeah, absolutely. For me, you're right, the squad is a major character in this book. And the mentality that makes a detective, that was one of the main things that I was thinking about. See, I'm lucky. I know a retired detective who's been incredibly generous with his time over the last, 12 years. He has answered so many questions for me. And a couple of years back, I rang him up and I said, do you mind giving me an idea of how you would go about interrogating a suspect in this specific set of circumstances? And he said, yeah, sure. And he gave me, just off the top of his head, a quick idea, demonstration of how he would go about it using me as a hypothetical suspect, right? And it was a revelation. This genuinely lovely guy, like a really nice, sound, easygoing, friendly guy, transformed, like flicking a switch, into this full-on, unstoppable force just bearing down on me. Mm-hmm. He was the complete controller of the situation. It wasn't that he was being aggressive exactly. It was just that he was going to get what he wanted. And nothing was going to stand in his way, and I had no say in this at all. I mean, he was doing this as a favor for me, and I was only on the phone, and I was leaning back in my chair against this freight train force bearing down on me. And that stuck with me, and I started to think about how that kind of power and control has to be a skill that every detective has. It just has to be. There's no other way to make people speak against their own interests, you know, a reluctant witness to give you info, a suspect to confess. You have to be able to take that kind of power and control. And then I started thinking about what it would be like working in a squad room full of a couple of dozen people who all have this skill. They all have this other mode right at their fingertips, accessible at a moment's notice. And what it would be like if it was turned on you suddenly, this force. If you were one of the detectives, you're supposed to be in a position of power here. And suddenly this force and this controlling power is being turned on you from every side and every day. And I had already written in Antoinette as not getting on well with her squad, not being very good at playing with others. And I started to think, what if that had gone wrong? What if that had gone further into a spiral? And she was feeling this coming at her the whole time. The squad room had turned from her safe place into an enemy. What would that do to her sense of reality, of herself within reality? And what if she got a case where things could be interpreted in a variety of ways and she couldn't tell how much was her paranoia and how much was reality. So the squad room, from the start of this book, was going to be the heart of it, and the atmosphere in the squad room was going to be the heart of the problem for Antoinette.
Yes, but also the whole search for the killer, her work on this case in some way parallels her own search for self, and she experiences an epiphany about herself in this book that actually changes how she sees herself in relationship to the world around her.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. She's been very convinced that she has a very clear idea of what's going on around her, and gradually over the course of the book she starts to realize that the story isn't at all what she thought it was, that there are many more shades of gray, and that she is not, in fact, necessarily the persecuted warrior going down in flames, and that it doesn't have to work that way, that she's been shaping it just as much as anybody else has, and that she has a choice, in fact, to shape it differently. And that's a very strange feeling for her, very strange and disorientating, and for her to come to terms with it, she's practically dragged kicking and screaming to that moment where she has that realization.
Now, she's the main character in this book. Do you have a vision of another book in which she'll be the minor character?
I'm actually working on the next book, but it's a little bit different. The narrator isn't a detective this time, and he hasn't appeared in any of the other books. I mean, there still is a murder in there, because I don't think I know how to write a book without throwing a dead body in there to get the action. But he's just a normal guy who, at the lowest point in his life, finds himself in the middle of a murder investigation, and he has to figure out not only what he should do about it, but also how he has wound up there to start with. So Antoinette isn't in it, as far as I know. I'm still very early on, and I don't really know where I'm going with a book before I get into it. So I'm not sure which detectives or where will show up.
Well, we really hope to talk with you about that one. And thank you so much for talking with us, Tana French, about your latest, The Trespasser. It was just a terrific read.
Thank you. And thank you so much for having me back.
Tana French is the author of 5 previous novels in the Dublin Murder Squad series, including The Secret Place, which we talked with her about in 2014. The Trespasser is published by Penguin Random House. Read an excerpt at writersvoice.net.
What's new, pussycat? Whoa, whoa, whoa. What's new, pussycat? Whoa, 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 whoa.
We have a few minutes left in today's show. That's a good thing, because it gives me a chance to share with you a message I got yesterday in my inbox from the writers' advocacy organization, PEN America. It's about a lawsuit PEN America has filed in federal court against President Donald Trump, in concert with the nonpartisan nonprofit Protect Democracy and the Yale Law School Media Freedom and Information Access Clinic. The message explains, quote, "The suit seeks to stop President Trump from using the machinery of government to retaliate or threaten reprisals against journalists and media outlets for coverage he dislikes." It goes on to say, "President Trump's tirades against the press are not new. His cries of fake news are an almost daily occurrence. The White House has called for individual journalists to be fired, and the president has referred to the media as the enemy of the American people. This has created an environment of hostility toward the media, wherein journalists have been subject to death threats, needed bodyguards to cover political rallies, and have faced attacks in their newsrooms. The president has also threatened book publishers and authors who have published critical volumes. While many media outlets are unrelenting in their robust coverage, individual writers may think twice before publishing pieces or commentary that could put them in the White House's crosshairs. Over the last 18 months, PEN America has been doing research, reporting, advocacy, outreach events, and more to spotlight and call out the president's assaults on writers and journalists. Yet most of the president's verbal attacks on the press are speech that is protected under the First Amendment. Our country's broad protections for free speech allow the president to denigrate the press and even go after individual journalists by name. However, when President Trump crosses the line and threatens to use his authority to punish the media, or actually does so, it is vital for the courts to step in and affirm that such threats and reprisals are unconstitutional. PEN America has worked closely with leading First Amendment scholars and practitioners in private practice and academia in order to hone a request to the court to do just that. The lawsuit outlines four specific examples in which the president's credible threats and actual acts of retaliation violate the First Amendment's protection of a free press and lend credence to concerns that his intimidation goes beyond just rhetoric. 1. Using the Department of Justice to attempt to disrupt a merger involving CNN's parent company Time Warner with AT&T because of CNN coverage that the president found hostile. 2. Raising postal rates for Amazon because its founder and CEO, Jeff Bezos, owns the Washington Post, a newspaper that the president views as critical of him. 3. Interfering with White House press access. And 4. Threatening to revoke broadcast licenses. These actions do not just injure the specific targets of the president's ire in each instance. They're intended to intimidate all writers and journalists with the threat that critical coverage can meet with similar government retaliation. We believe that a court declaration that such acts by the president are unlawful will provide a powerful tool to push back against presidential efforts to retaliate against the media. Such a ruling would offer protection to journalists and writers threatened by President Trump so that they can continue to do their work without fear of reprisal from the government. As an organization of writers, we at PEN America are deeply concerned to see the antagonism toward the press that we've long associated with authoritarian rulers around the world manifest here at home. We forcefully raised concerns about free expression infringements during the Obama, Bush, and other prior administrations, including in some instances by filing suit. Given our mission to defend free expression and support those who pay a price for its exercise, we are determined to rise in defense of the press freedom protections that are so fundamental to our society and democracy. That's from PEN America. Go to writersvoice.net for links to the announcement and to read the lawsuit. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word. The Writer's Voice webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.